loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, we discuss what was yesterday the big news of the day, and today, not so big. The Democratic National Committee yesterday, it was reported, called the FBI to say that they had suffered a hack, an email hack once again. Well, it turned out it wasn't a hack, even though there was much speculation in the media that maybe Russia did it once again. It was a test, a security test run by the Michigan Democratic National Committee against the Democratic National Committee. Anyway, we're going to talk through what this meant, what the media said and did about this. Then, adopting another talking point of the extreme right wing, President Donald Trump has asked that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo take a look at the, quote, large-scale killing of farmers, close quote, in South Africa, referring to the white landowners whose property is subject to a new redistribution program aimed at addressing the legacy of apartheid. And then today we continue, as we do every Thursday, our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. Today, we focus on the massive prison strike taking place in more than a dozen states.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the United States and China imposed 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of each other's goods today as the Trump administration's trade war continues to gather steam. What will the consequences be for the two countries' economies and the world? Next, tonight in 1968, 43 black GIs who were stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, refused to board a plane to go fight against protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Many of these soldiers had already been to war in Vietnam, and this was a huge act of dissent, foreshadowing much more dissent within the ranks of the military in decades to come. Then, NSA contractor Reality Winner was sentenced today to 63 months in prison, or more than 5 years. She was charged under the Espionage Act for leaking to the press a report on alleged Russian election interference, and this is the highest sentence yet for this crime. And then, the British government released 25 guidance documents for people and businesses in the case that no Brexit deal is agreed upon between the EU and the UK, which would leave the UK without any agreements on trade, diplomacy, and other relationships with the EU. And finally, the US has had a long and contentious debate about affirmative action, which is one policy intended to help with centuries of structural oppression of people of color and women. Most recently, the opposition to affirmative action has shifted to blaming the policy for keeping high-performing Asian-American students out of elite places like Harvard. But what sort of effects on Asian-American students are actually at play? And in other headlines, California Republican U.S. Representative Duncan Hunter and his wife pleaded not guilty today to misuse of $250,000 in campaign funds. This is the second Republican member of the House to be charged with financial crimes this month. On August 8th, U.S. Representative Christopher Collins of New York was charged with insider trading. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced today that Steve Biegun will serve as the new special envoy in charge of relations with North Korea. Biegun previously served as a high-level Senate staffer and later worked at the National Security Council during the George W. Bush administration. He will focus on the complicated process of negotiations kicked off by the Singapore summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. As of the end of last month, there are 8,000 lawsuits against Monsanto's weed killers. Just this month, the first ever award was administered in a case against Monsanto's products that contain glyphosate, such as Roundup and Ranger Pro. 46-year-old Dwayne Lee Johnson was diagnosed with cancer after years of using Monsanto's product Roundup as a groundskeeper, and this was the first ever award that was given. An analyst at brokerage firm Berenberg callously noted about these lawsuits against cancer-causing chemicals, quote, "While this is disappointing, it's not surprising. Indeed, in our litigation scenario analysis, we assumed a doubling of cases to 10,400. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu began his trip to the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia today. Netanyahu said the purpose of his visit was to develop relations with Eastern European countries to counteract fraying ties with Western European governments, which have become increasingly critical of Israeli human rights abuses. Netanyahu begins his tour today in Lithuania, the first ever visit by an Israeli prime minister to that country. Those are today's headlines, and you are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Headlines in major news outlets across the country sounded the alarm about what they said was yet another sinister, probably Russian attempt to subvert American democracy, a hack into the Democratic National Committee's voter database this week. But it turns out that this was nothing more than a security test by one of its state affiliates. We're joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rawl.com. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Ted, Walter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Ted, here we are, Thursday. Today's front page still on the Wall Street Journal was DNC reports attempted hacking, and it's all about how the DNC has gone to the FBI. The article today in the Wall Street Journal, and this is not unusual, quotes the Democratic National Committee Chief Security Officer Bob Lord, who said, "This attempt is further proof that there are constant threats as we head into the midterm elections, and we must remain vigilant in order to prevent future attacks." Anyway, kind of mud on their face, but maybe not. Maybe not that many people will notice. Maybe the original headline still dominates.
I would count on that. A lot of people won't read the story. That's often the case, especially in the age of the internet, with news alerts flashing on people's smartphones. I guess I have a different definition of proof than he does. At this point, how many times are these guys going to cry wolf? I do think the American public has ceased paying attention to the extent that they ever did. I think there was some initial interest in this story, and when evidence, much less proof, never materialized, the interests of the American voters have drifted off elsewhere. Sometimes that's a bad thing. I think in this particular case, it is a testimony to the intelligence of the American people. There's no there. And that's what I'm hearing from people in Washington from across the political spectrum. Insiders know that there really is just, if there was a there, we would have heard it by now, I think.
Walter, what happened? What actually happened?
There was an effort or a security test by the Michigan Democratic National, or by the Michigan Democratic Committee, right? So the state entities that compose the Democratic Party are technically separate. So they conducted this test without informing the National Committee, which is legally speaking its own separate entity. And so there was this other, it's from this company called Lookout, and they had software installed onto the voter database that wasn't actually supposed to detect this type of thing. But because it was just built well, it ended up detecting it. And so the DNC was alerted to it. They called the FBI, right? So they contacted the FBI. They obviously contacted all these different media outlets. And, yesterday afternoon, there was this big national phenomenon around it, national news story.
The summer of 2016, Ted, the Democratic National Committee private security firm at that time, CrowdStrike, reported to the FBI that the DNC had been hacked, and that's how WikiLeaks ultimately got hold of DNC emails and files that showed that the DNC, which was basically fundamentally and controlled and financed by Hillary Clinton or the Hillary Clinton campaign, had basically messed up or violated its own rules in an effort to squelch Bernie Sanders' campaign bid and to give the nomination to Hillary Clinton. At that time, the DNC refused to give over the server or servers of the DNC to the FBI for a forensic investigation. I mean, when you think about the fact that this became headlines this week, and then the DNC, as it turns out, had to point out that, well, the hack, which would have obviously been meant to look like Russians or some foreign either state or non-state actor, was actually by the Michigan Democratic Party. Why would we be not skeptical back then or about 2016 that maybe it wasn't the Russians, or maybe it was somebody trying to look like Russians, or maybe it was the Iowa Democratic Committee. I mean, given the nature of this thing, why have the American people been told accept this as an absolute truth when it came to Russia?
Well, as we've discussed before, I think that what's going on here is that the Russia campaign is an attempt to pivot the national security apparatus, the state, into a mode of away from the anti-Al-Qaeda, anti-radical Islamic global war on terror that began in the Bush years and continued into Obama, into an anti-regional power, anti-superpower narrative, these days being against Russia, and now they're floating China. The purpose of these campaigns is to justify the continued expenditure of over 50% of federal tax dollars on defense and intelligence and debt service on former intelligence and debt and war boondoggles. And they want this to continue. So there needs to be an ongoing threat, and Russia has been elected to play that role, whether they actually had anything, whether they're actually active in trying to meddle in American elections or not. I think the motive is that it's sort of why wouldn't people be skeptical? I mean, look, we've all learned to be skeptical of stories and narratives that sound a little bit outlandish, especially when there's no evidence, much less proof, offered to support them. So people have tuned out. The polls show it. Fewer than 1% of Americans think of Russia as a problem. Americans are focused on other matters.
We're joined from New York by Ted Rull. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rull.com. Ted, I'm looking at a headline from The Guardian yesterday. It's DNC detects attempt to hack voter database just months before midterms. So in addition to this fitting in with the pre-existing narrative about, Russian meddling in general, there's this sort of sub-narrative about how, the 2018 midterms are under attack. And I mean, that's the language that's used, right? It's under siege.
Who are the Russian candidates, though? Who are the pro-Russian candidates in the 2018 midterm elections? They said Iran, North Korea. This was Bolton the other day. Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia. I'm thinking like, okay, who are the Russian pro-Russian members of the running for the Democrats and Republicans? Who are the pro-Iranian? Anyway, go ahead, Ted.
Well, what's funny is a lot of this narrative is sort of just a hiccup from 2016, where at the time it was no secret that Russia was afraid of a Hillary Clinton candidacy. She was such a hawk that there were military analysts in the Kremlin. The Foreign Policy did an excellent piece about it that indicated that Russia was terrified that Hillary Clinton might be elected president. So it was no secret that President Putin would have preferred that Donald Trump be elected. So then the narrative about Russiagate began was that Russia was behind Trump and Trump's win. The problem with that now is that they're continuing this, and there's no pro-Russia political party anymore, because you have President Trump, for example, is his figures, like National Security Advisor John Bolton, are bashing Russia and accusing Russia of election meddling. So the Democrats have been screaming Russiagate at the top of their lungs. The Republicans have joined the chorus. Many top figure Republicans in Congress have done the same. So, like, why on earth would that, like, not be still? I mean, where exactly are the pro Russian forces? I don't know.
Walter, there was an article in Sputnik that came out last night. More Americans favor improved relations with Russia over sanctions. Sputnik says nearly 60% of Americans say it's more important to improve relations with Russia than it is to take a strong diplomatic economic steps against Russia. That's a Gallup poll. But interestingly, Gallup also reported that 2/3 of Americans say they are following Trump-Russian news closely or very closely. And 3/4 say Russia interfered in the 2016 election with just 16% saying the Russians did not interfere. 39% say Russia interfered and changed the election outcome, a position not espoused by the U.S. government, meaning the Trump administration, of course. Those are some really interesting statistics. Most people want to improve relations with Russia, which makes sense. But most people also believe the narrative that the Russians did interfere in the elections in 2016. And a good number of Americans also believe that it had an impact on the outcome of the 2016 elections. So the whole the overall narrative, and here we have the DNC saying they were hacked, probably by the Russians. It turns out it was the Michigan State Party. There has been created a climate of fear and hostility and sort of an understanding about Russia that it is an evil, malign player, but the U.S. should still have better relations with it. Interesting contradiction.
Yeah, there are a couple of different pieces there. I mean, one, there's just sort of what I think is common sense to the most ordinary people, that the two largest nuclear superpowers should have good relations with each other for the good of everybody on the planet. And people don't want war. People know that it's their children who are going to be sent to fight, not the children of the generals and the politicians and the businessmen. But, you know, because of the total mobilization of all the different institutions that can shape public opinion behind this Russiagate narrative, it's really not surprising to me that, you know, 75% of people or 70-some percent of people would say, well, okay, yes, they tried to interfere in our elections. But then you have this other segment of the population that's been so carried away by it that they'll believe just things that nobody's even claiming, like they changed the vote totals or just absurdities like that.
Yeah, I hear you. And again, Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote by 3.5 million. If it wasn't for the Electoral College, she would, in fact, be president. Anyway, that was the voice of Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. We were also joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. That's RALL.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Adopting another talking point of the extreme right wing, President Donald Trump has asked that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo take a look at, quote, the large-scale killing of farmers, close quote, in South Africa, referring to the white landowners whose property is subject to new redistribution programs aimed at addressing the legacy of apartheid. This comes after Fox News host Tucker Carlson called South African President Ramaphosa a racist. We're joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including From the Barrel of a Gun, The United States and the War Against Zimbabwe. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Dr. Horn and Walter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So, Dr. Horn, Donald Trump has an affinity, a profound affinity for the rich white farmers in South Africa. Not surprising, but still, we should be shocked, no?
No. I'm afraid to say that Donald J. Trump is seeking to deflect attention from his various and multiple legal problems, as suggested by the guilty plea against his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, and the copping of a plea by his former fixer, Michael Cohen. I think we in the United States, however, should be disturbed for a number of reasons. Number one, I think we should ask very deep, searching, and profound questions as to why Mr. Trump feels that raising a question of saving the bacon, if you like, of farmers across the Atlantic and South Africa will somehow titillate his base. I say that we may come to the conclusion that there was a premature declaration of victory in this country over U.S.-style apartheid and the sentiments that undergirded it. And Mr. Trump recognizes that fact more than most, which is why he continually raises sensitive issues of race and racism, not only with regard to South Africa, but with regard to National Football League athletes who are predominantly African-American. But he's also playing with fire because this question of land is a very touchy and sensitive one. I'm sure you know what's transpired across the border in Zimbabwe, which, by the way, out of a population of 17 million, only has about 100,000 of European descent, whereas in South Africa, out of a population of about 50 to 55 million, there are about 4 to 5 million of European descent. And when Zimbabwe moved towards land reform and seizing the land of that European minority, it caused all hell to break loose in terms of sanctions being imposed by the United States, which were just reimposed in the last few weeks. And the South African situation is even more dangerous, even more sensitive. And I would hope and trust that Congress would move to censure Mr. Trump for interfering so grossly in the internal affairs of a sovereign state.
Those are really important points, Walter. I mean, this could be one of those stories of unintended consequences, because there are, as Dr. Horn is pointing out, the population of whites who dominated South Africa is substantially larger than what was the case in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. They may feel they have numbers there, and upsetting the apple cart might be just the kind of thing that, far from diminishing the authority of those favoring black majority rule in all ways, including land, it might do just the opposite. It might inflame the struggle.
I think that's accurate, and especially as it pertains to the new political forces that are emerging in South Africa. I mean, the resolution in the South African parliament to go forward with this program of it's referred to as land reform without compensation, right? And, you know, even though the no compensation part might sound harsh to an audience not familiar with the situation, I mean, it means no compensation for the people who stole the land and enslaved the people and imposed this horrific racial dictatorship on the country for so many centuries. And its most extreme form, you know, the formal apartheid system from 1945 to 1994, that was proposed by the economic freedom fighters. There's this new generation of people who are carrying on the struggle that was initiated by people like Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Joe Slovo, and all the different freedom fighters who we know, saying that, well, you know, we've overthrown apartheid, we've overthrown this racial dictatorship, but now we have to have a redistribution of the wealth, and one of the most fundamental things is a redistribution of the land.
Go ahead, Dr. Horn.
Well, I find even more striking is the fact that, sadly and unfortunately, Donald J. Trump is not alone in his interference in the internal affairs of South Africa. Recall that just a few months ago, Peter Dutton, who was a part of the cabinet in Australia and may be replacing Malcolm Trumbull in an internal party coup before the week is over in Australia, in March, he said that Australia should put on the fast track visas for farmers of European ancestry who supposedly are being persecuted and terrorized. So we see that there's a kind of white international erupting, a white reactionary international, which I dare say also carries the seeds of fascism, particularly given the unsettled history in South Africa, where, by the way, the European invasion commenced in 1652 as opposed to the 1890s in Zimbabwe, once Rhodesia, which suggests that the roots of white supremacy and racism are much deeper in South Africa. And this external interference in the affairs of South Africa is quite dangerous. And I hope that these politicians are reminded of the danger of what they're doing.
And just like there is this, you know, growing, I guess, solidarity, you could call it, between these reactionary white political forces in, you know, South Africa, the United States, Australia, the question of land and land reform is something that's very, very important all throughout Southern Africa and the African continent as a whole. Namibia, you know, the issue of land reform is now on the agenda. Do you see this having a broader regional implication?
Well, certainly, because land reform is also a burning issue in Namibia, South Africa's northern neighbor, which you recall was actually subjected to an illegal occupation by South Africa from the end of World War I, when the League of Nations gave South Africa a mandate, until Namibian independence in 1990. Recall as well that we're not only talking about land reform, we're talking about the opposite side of the coin, which is settler colonialism. And recall that one of the reasons why the wars in Southern Africa were so bloody was precisely because of settler colonialism. That is to say, Europeans invading that part of Africa digging deep roots there. And it's not just Southern Africa as well. Kenya as well was subjected to settler colonialism. And then in the north of the continent, Algeria endured a very bloody and bitter struggle from the early 1950s until independence in 1962, precisely because of settler colonialism that almost led to the toppling of the French government. France, of course, was the source of the settlers in Algeria. So once again, Mr. Trump is playing with dynamite, and I hope that Congress intervenes in order to bring him to his senses.
The origin of this idea of the large-scale killing of white farmers in South Africa, right, which is what Donald Trump is now instructing Secretary of State Pompeo to investigate. I don't think we've explicitly said it yet in this interview, but that's nonsense. There is no large-scale killing of white South African farmers. The origin, there's this disgusting racist narrative that's pushed by what's, you know, referred to as the alt-right in the United States, you know, the Nazis, the Klansmen, the fascists. Of quote unquote white genocide, that, you know, white people are under siege and they have to rise up. That idea, that concept, that originated with the far right in South Africa, the far right that wants to bring back the apartheid system. It migrated to the United States, was adopted by the fascists in the United States. And now we have the president of the United States talking about it. I mean, it's really remarkable, sort of the contagion of these extreme racist ideas.
Well, I hope and I trust the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who Mr. Trump instructed to investigate this particular situation, will ignore that particular suggestion. And given the fact that Mr. Trump has a rather slight attention span, I don't think Mr. Pompeo will get into any difficulty as a result of ignoring that particular directive. But as you suggest, this is part of a canard that's being spread not only in South Africa, but also in the United States, that those who are defined as white are under siege. And therefore, because they are supposedly under siege, they can take extreme measures, if you like, to defend themselves. And this is quite a remarkable statement, but once again, it's quite dangerous. And it helps to shed light on the spate of police killings in the United States of America. It helps to shed light on these incidents where people are rousted from a Starbucks from simply sitting there, or rousted from a park in Oakland from barbecuing, because they're being propelled by this ridiculous notion that those who are defined as white are losing, quote, their country, unquote, and therefore they are easily seduced by such simplistic slogans as, quote, make America great again, unquote. That is to say, return to the days of yesteryear when Jim Crow stalked the land.
We've got just about a minute left. We're talking with Dr. Gerald Horn. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many books, including From the Barrel of a Gun, The United States and the War Against Zimbabwe.
You know, let me just ask in our last minute, Dr. Horn, when we think about what happened in Germany in 1931, 32, eventually then in 1933, the rise of fascism, the taking of power by Hitler, there was a profound economic crisis, much more profound than what the United States is experiencing. But what evolved, what triumphed really was the cult of race or the cult of nationality from the point of view of fascist propaganda. Donald Trump is not Hitler. This is not a fascist moment. The fascists are not taking power. We're not about to have unions and all progressive organizations shut down or close down. So there's no reason to think about that. But from an ideological point of view, it's the reintroduction of the cult of race and nationality. How big of a deal is it, do you think, in terms of the political discourse going forward?
I think it's a huge deal. I think it's a huge deal, number one, because I think that many of our friends on the left have downplayed the origins of the United States, born in a revolt against the abolition of slavery, an edict emanating from London in Somerset's case in 1772, and also born as a result of another edict emanating from London, calling for the settlers to stop moving west, seizing the land of the Native Americans, the Royal Proclamation of 1762. In other words, this country was born in a white supremacist revolt, and because we haven't honestly confronted that ugly history, it leaves us ill-prepared to confront these kinds of episodes that we see today, where Donald J. Trump feels that he can stir up his base by appealing to the most primitive and reactionary racist sentiments. Until we come to grips with that history, we won't be able to come to grips with this ugly reality we're now confronting.
With that said, I want to urge our listeners to go and find Gerald Horne's books, Dr. Horne, the last name is spelled H-O-R-N-E, including the history of the formation of these United States, the Counter-Revolution of 1776. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today, we continue our weekly series every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News, PLN. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a producer of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. And also Walter Smolarek, another producer of Loud and Clear and also a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome to the three of you.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Paul, remarkable development right now, nationwide prison strike going from August 21st, the day of the assassination or execution of George Jackson in 1971, all the way up to September 9th, which is also the beginning of the Attica Rebellion in the same year. Let's talk about the strike, what its significance is, who's participating. Go ahead.
Well, I think what's significant about it is this is one of the, it's only been in the recent years, in the last two or three years, that we've seen even the aspiration or the goal of a national prison strike. Historically, for most of the past 200 years, prison strikes and prison organizing's focused on, at best, individual prisons. And every once in a while, it would expand out to maybe statewide efforts. I organized a successful statewide strike, labor strike in the Washington prison system in 1994. And at that time, I think that was the first effort to do a statewide strike, at least in Washington, if not nationally. And then a couple years ago, California prisoners, they successfully did hunger strikes in statewide in the California prison system to protest solitary confinement and the California prison system's punitive isolation practices against, you know, real and alleged gang members. So, you know, so we've kind of been seeing kind of this evolution. And so now we're at the point of prisoners seeking to organize statewide or nationwide prison strike around core demands. But the one of the key things, though, is around prisoner status as literally slaves of the state and their the exploitation of their labor and the exploitation of literally the financial exploitation of prisoners and their families for the benefit of prison systems and the corporations that collaborate with them. So I think this is really a historic event, just the extent that it's even happening or the and that prisoners themselves are conceptualizing it.
Yeah, I think it definitely is a very historic event, Paul. And one of those reasons is just how large this strike is, how many organizations are signed on. And also the demands, which, you know, I have a copy of right here. There's 11 demands, and they're very widespread. They're very, very important demands, and they're covering a bunch of different parts of the injustices in the system, including conditions, including slavery, as you talked about, including some of the really terrible laws that have come into place the last couple of decades, like the Truth in Sentencing Act that eliminated the possibility of parole in the federal system, as well as some of the really racist gang enhancement laws, not being able to have access to Pell Grants. It's a really important list. It's not exhaustive. There are so many issues going on in the prison system, but it is a really important list. Could you talk a little bit more about the demands as well?
Yes, I think that, you know, some of the key demands, everything are, you know, in a lot of respects, are very fundamental things, like the right to vote for people in prison and on probation outside of prison. Then the whole thing that prisoners be allowed to pay or be allowed to be paid the prevailing wage for their labor, and also, more importantly, to keep it. The right to adequate medical care, the right to an education in prison. You know, I think these are very fundamental human rights that are being demanded. And the other thing is, in some respects, and one of the things, too, is to repeal the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which has made it virtually impossible for, you know, for prisoners to have their claims heard in federal court. And, you know, I think these are all things, these are very fundamental and basic demands, which I think in a lot of respects, the demands themselves kind of illustrate, I think it illustrates why the American prison system is so barbaric, because when you start looking at the overall, you know, the basic conditions that prisoners are being subjected to, and part of it is just that, you know, when they ask for simple things like prison policies that recognize the humanity of imprisoned men and women, you know, these are very fundamental things, and it also targets the whole, you know, the whole basis of the American criminal justice system at this point, you know. And it's a ten point demand, which, you know, is fairly basic, and you know, but at its core is the improvement of conditions and the end of prison slavery, that prisoners be paid the prevailing wage for their labor. And I think that's just such a fundamental demand, and one that, most importantly, prisons and jails are totally incapable of meeting, because the whole system of American incarceration is premised upon the enslavement of the people being held captive in it.
You know, the prospect of a work stoppage is very powerful when you step back and consider just how widespread the use of prison labor is, how widespread the circulation of goods produced, at least in part, by prisoners are in the United States. To sort of illustrate the power of a strike, could you just talk a little bit about that? I mean, what would it mean if, and, you know, and this is the case in lots of places right now, even if it's not the entire prison system, but what if every prisoner went on strike in the United States? I mean, what would that do to the economy?
It wouldn't do much to the American economy as a whole, to the extent that, you know, we have, what, a $10 trillion economy or whatever. But what it would do is it'd bring the prisons themselves and the jails down to a screeching halt, because so much of the labor that's associated with the running of the prisons and jails in this country is performed by prison slave labor. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when you talk to prison officials, they treat prison strikes and work stoppages more seriously than they do hostage takings. The only thing they treat more seriously than work stoppages or prison strikes is an escape. And because they recognize and they realize that at its fundamental level, the prison strike, prisoners withholding their labor, is the most fundamental thing that prisoners can do that really strikes at the heart of this system of mass incarceration and a smooth-running system. And I think that's the same thing. If you look at it, any system of forced servitude is enforced with ruthless violence by the overseers and the slavers, and it's because it relies upon the subservience and the acquiescence of the enslaved, you know, for the system to keep running and to keep doing its thing. And I think if you think about it, is if they didn't have prisoners performing these jobs, and I think the key thing to remember is that the importance of prison slave labor isn't so much the 5,000 prisoners that are working for private corporations, and it's not the 60,000 prisoners or so that are working for correctional industries, making everything from license plates to road signs and whatever. The big use of prison slave labor is the use of prisoners who cook the food for prisoners, who do the laundry, who sweep the tiers, who act as prison nurses. This is where the real labor thing is, because if they didn't have prisoners doing this stuff for no pay or nominal pay as it stands now, presumably they would have to hire people at the minimum, at more than the minimum wage, with benefits to do this work. It would have to be, they'd have to hire more prison cooks. They would have to hire prison laundry people to do this. And that's part of the reason why, to the extent the United States spends $90 billion a year operating its prisons and jails, those numbers would be much higher if they didn't use prison slave labor, if they actually had to pay people the prevailing wage or hire people to do it. So that's, I think, you know, kind of the critical, I think, the critical thing here is that that's where the cost would go, that's where the money would go, and it would cost a lot more. And that's the thing, is what the United States wants to do, and I think this is what every totalitarian system that's relied on mass incarceration, whether it's Nazi concentration camps or the convict leasing system in this country, even chattel slavery, is, you know, you want to have your slaves maintained for as little money as possible and get as much work out of them as possible and have as little expense involved as possible. And that's pretty much what we have happening here. And I think that, you know, American prison officials are, I think, you know, rightly concerned that if the slaves aren't down with it, the whole edifice runs the risk of collapsing. And I think we saw this a lot in with Gandhi's campaign in India. So it was the same basic premise. Gandhi's thing was that Indians shouldn't allow themselves to be financially exploited by British imperialism. And if they withheld their labor and stopped buying British products and bought Indian-made products, that potentially that entire system would collapse. And, you know, he may or may not have been right, but that was the premise behind it.
Paul, I think that's such a good point. I think that a lot of the inner workings of prisons and how all of that is really run by the prisoners themselves is really invisible. We're, I think, more aware of the privatization and the companies that make money off of prisoners doing this labor. And for example, the prison enterprises that makes, you know, all sorts of things, jeans, license plates, like you said, all kinds of things. But you're totally right that many, many prisons are completely run by the labor of prisoners for little or no money. I was walking through the Angola prison in Louisiana, a very famous prison that used to be a plantation, and you can't tell the difference from photos, from old photos. Yeah, exactly. And they're, you know, it is 3,000 men, you know, struggling, working, harvesting on a plantation, and the whole point is to grow enough food for the entire Louisiana prison system. So they have all of that in-house and all of that for almost no money. So they're able to feed, you know, everyone in Louisiana prisons, which is a lot of people, for, you know, for almost no money.
And you know, I was friends with some of the prisoners when they got out from in Texas. And Paul, you'll know this case well. I mean, the Texas prison system was, you know, just based on a plantation economy, the worst of the worst kind of conditions, predominantly let Mexicans and black people and poor whites. But I mean, it was a plantation system straight away. Has it changed at all? Because, you know, back in the 1970s and the 1980s, there was litigation, there were prisoner strikes. What's it like in Texas?
It's still abysmal. I mean, these are incredibly barbaric systems. Texas, Florida, Arkansas, and Mississippi are four prison systems that do not pay their prisoners anything, not even a token amount. They don't even pretend to pay prisoners the 3 cents a day that they're paid in Louisiana. There's nothing. Prisoners are just flat-out slaves of the state. They're just enslaved for their labor and forced to work with no pay. There are no legal ways to earn money in those prison systems. And, you know, and I think that that's the key thing is, you know, it's also, these are systems that, you know, create and perpetuate slavery. They want the infantilization and economic disenfranchisement of prisoners as well. So, you know, so these are all, you know, these are all things that, you know, these systems perpetuate. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the reforms that have come, it's worth noting when you mentioned Texas that up until federal court orders banned the practice, you went to prison systems in Texas and Arkansas and places like that, prisoners were armed with guns. They provided the perimeter security and the internal security within the prisoners, within the prisons. And prison officials thought, and this is within living memory, this is an ancient history, this was as recently as the 1980s. Prisoners were armed with guns and with rifles and shotguns and provided the security staffing of these prisons. The Arkansas prison system in the 1970s, before a federal judge banned the practice, had 27 non-prisoner employees and 3,000 prisoners. And all the other labor, was, including that of armed guards, was provided by prisoners. And again, this is, you know, these are like direct lines out of the plantation economy of the Deep South. But you see similar systems. I mean, the Nazi concentration camp system is a very, it's a very relevant example, just the extent that it was a system premised upon the economic exploitation of prisoners, and they had prisoners doing a lot of the security functions. They called them capos. And in Texas, they called them building tenders. So, you know, but the fundamental functions that are being carried out are pretty much the same. And it's all about the government enslaving people, using some sections of the oppressed to police and lord over the others, and to make some money off of it.
Walter, you look surprised about that prisoners were actually functioning as the armed guards.
Yeah, I am shocked. I did not know that.
Paul, most people don't know that. It's not just Walter.
Yeah, because the media has done a really good job of putting things down the memory hole, so that in this country we have no past. You know, we barely have a present, and we're certainly not going to have a future. So, you know, it's like George Orwell said, you know, whoever controls the present controls the past. And that's one of the things, that everything that happens in America happens in a historical and political vacuum, you know. And I think that's part of the problem, is that, you know, the reality that prisoners live in this country is, you know, for the most part, not really discussed. And the reality that they lived not that long ago is also not really discussed or thought about. And I think the other thing that we got to keep in mind too is the conditions that American prisoners are subjected to range from barbaric to horrific. And as I sit here in Florida, Texas, nearly all the states of the former Confederate South, they've made the political decision not to have air conditioning in their prisons. You know, the whole theory here is that prisoners have to suffer. And, you know, I don't know what the temperature is like there in D.C., but, you know, here in Florida, we're running around 100 degrees or so this time of year. And the idea of being, you know, locked up in a cage with no air conditioning in Florida or Texas or Louisiana at the height of summer is, you know, it's pretty crazy. What's even more bizarre is the fact that the guards who work in these conditions, they're down with it too. In California or other places, or Arizona, where the guards are better organized in their unions, they look at it as a bad working condition, so they wouldn't subject themselves to it. But of course, they're fine subjecting the prisoners to it. But the fact that here in the United States, as a routine matter, they've made the decision to, you know, deliberately inflict punishment and cruelty and barbarism on people in their captivity just for its own sake, that's what's kind of unique about the United States compared to other countries.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. Paul joins us every Thursday in this series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people. Paul Wright is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News, PLN. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, a producer of this show and a Sputnik News analyst, and also Walter Smolarek, also a producer of this show and also a Sputnik News analyst. You know, you mentioned Orwell, and Orwell said, whoever controls the present controls the past, meaning they have the dominance of ideas about what came before, why history led to a certain place. Karl Marx put it in a slightly different way, but perhaps with the same intent, meaning, he said, the ideas of any society are the ideas of its ruling class. They control opinion molding through the media, through religious institutions, through schools, through academia, through all kinds of networks that shape and influence and mold opinion. And that's why I think this show and the work of Prison Legal News is so important, because while those things are true, we also believe that change can happen, meaning that the present can evolve into, or maybe evolve, maybe evolution, maybe it's not evolution, maybe it's revolution, go to some other place where people can live differently if people start to learn the truth. And Paul, I think that's so important. And part of the truth-telling is when the people who are sort of the targets of history, like the prisoners, for instance, who are caricatured and stereotyped, who don't have names, don't have faces, don't have voices, when they start to finally emerge and rise up, then they have an opportunity to tell their stories, because they emerge out of invisibility to visibility and into humanity. And that's what these prisoners are really trying to do, to emerge into visibility and to be able to express their humanity. Go ahead.
Well, I think the bigger thing, too, is that, you know, generally no one likes to be exploited. And we see this throughout history. And, you know, we see this whether it's, you know, and any type of slave system faces its slave revolts, you know, whether it was Nat Turner or Denmark Vesey in the U.S., where there's the slave rebellions in ancient Rome led by Spartacus, or in Brazil, or whatever. And, you know, the slavers, you know, their task or the goal or the problem they face is, you know, keeping the exploitation machine going while making sure that the system, their system, keeps working. And one of the things I think is interesting to note, though, is that, you know, the United States has enshrined slavery in the 13th Amendment, which limits, it didn't abolish slavery, it just limited to people that had been convicted for crime. And that, I think, is one of the problems that, you know, whenever I've been asked if, you know, I support the Constitution as well, you know, I'm against slavery. So that's kind of like a non-starter for me. But I think the bigger thing is when you look around at the American political class and its corporate media and the political class's media, is pretty much everyone's down with prison slavery. You know, no one is suggesting or saying that prisoners should be paid for their labor. You know, that's just viewed, and it's interesting because, you know, when I've spent many, many years reporting on prison slavery in this country, and it's interesting is when you look at American coverage of prison slave labor in China, it's viewed as a human rights violation. It's viewed as an egregious problem and one that needs to be ended. Ironically, this imperialist contradiction is expressed in the fact that the United States bans the import of convict and prisoner-made goods from other countries.
Yeah, that is amazing.
And makes it a felony. On the other hand, the U.S. exports prison-made and convict-made goods. Every license plate in the country of El Salvador is made by prisoners in the state of Texas who are paid nothing for their slave labor. And, you know, we see this time after time again, is it's okay for American prisoners to be enslaved, not okay for other countries to use their prison slave labor. And I think these are just things that we see just time after time again.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, oh, I was just going to say, politically, we don't see anyone in the political establishment from either party having a problem with the notion of prison enslavement.
There's a couple other issues we want to get to here in the last 4 minutes, one of which is that, you know, we've been talking about all the slave labor, and one of the frequent forms of that in California is the firefighters who fight these big fires out in California who are prisoners. And what we've seen this week is an even additional layer of oppression. Verizon has been throttling data for the people who are trying to fight fires out in California, which, you know, is not a luxury. That's a really important thing for people to have as they're trying to coordinate, you know, crisis responses. So that's been happening out in Santa Clara, out in Northern California, and it's absolutely insane. Have you heard about the story at all, Paul?
No, I hadn't. So they're throttling the data?
Yeah, they're throttling the data, and the Verizon's response has been that these firefighters should go ahead and just get a more expensive plan, and then that would aid the faster internet that they might need.
Okay, now that's like, this is the epitome of capitalism. We have slave labor firefighters out in the field, but get a more expensive plan so that your cell phone can actually work.
That's right. And one other issue I wanted to bring up today is actually good news. There's a $9 million settlement in a wrongful conviction case in Baltimore. It's the highest settlement in city history. And, you know, Criminal Legal News, your organization, Paul, has written that the reason the city agreed to pay such a high amount was in order to avoid a jury from hearing the shocking details of this conviction, which I'd like for you to talk about in a second. Any sort of wrongful conviction case always reminds me of Glenn Ford's just horrific case down in Louisiana. He was held being wrongfully convicted of murder for 30 years. He was held in Louisiana prisons for 30 years. He was exonerated. But because he was guilty of smaller crimes, the state denied him any compensation, even though he was dying of cancer during this time. So he was he had no money to pay any medical bills. Any money he was getting from supporters was going straight into hospice, and he died, exonerated, but with no money and no health care. Could you tell us a little bit more about this Owens case in Baltimore?
Yeah, so, and I think the one thing to keep in mind is that all too often prisoners that are wrongfully convicted of crimes they were factually innocent of never get any compensation at all. In the case of J.J. Owens, in 1987, a woman named Colleen Willier was raped and murdered, and as is all too often the case, a guy named James Thompson decided to collect a $1,000 reward by lying to the police about it. And by the time the police were done with it, Thompson had implicated himself and Owens in a crime in which neither was actually involved in. And this is actually, false confessions is actually a critical element in a lot of wrongful convictions. Anyways, the upshot is both men were tried, convicted of the rape murder, and sentenced to life without parole. And stunningly, it was almost 30 years later, until 2006, that semen found in the victim was tested, and it didn't match either Thompson or Owens. And they had a new trial, and then prosecutors refused to drop the charges unless the men accepted an Alford plea, which would have precluded the ability to, you know, to sue for the wrongful conviction. So Thompson, the guy who took the $1,000 the first time around to that got everyone involved in himself and no one's involved in this mess, took the plea deal and was released. Owen refused, and he spent another 16 months in prison contesting his innocence. And then on the very day he was supposed to have been tried, they dropped the charges and let him go free. So he took the case, he filed a lawsuit, and he filed suit and took it to court. And then during the settlement negotiations, a federal jury awarded a different Baltimore exoneree $15 million. And so at this point, after years of litigation and keeping him in prison for a long time, for literally for decades, knowing he was factually innocent, the city decided to settle for $9 million.
Wow.
And so basically it took him from 2008 when he was released, it took him almost 10 years fighting to get the $9 million in compensation before he actually got the money. And I think this is kind of like the logic of the American police state is, you know, they kill people, they cripple them, they rape them, they wrongfully convict them, and then they try to avoid any type of accountability or liability for their sleazy actions.
That's all the time we have. We've been joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's the editor of Prison Legal News. You can read his writings at prisonlegalnews.org. We were also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, a producer of this show, and Walter Smolarek, a producer of Loud and Clear. You stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.